11th chapter of Daniel. Now, beginning with verse 5 through verse 35 in this 11th chapter, we have a historical section. And last time we started reading some of that from Rennell Showers, who wrote the book, The Most High God, that we're using for our text in this, and most of you have copies of that. But he also gives his own translation, and I think most places it probably is a little more enlightening and gives you a little more of the understanding. A lot of times, just the English of the old King James, it gets confusing. It does me. I have to sometimes take it apart and try to put it back together to understand what the writer is, what the translators are saying. I think sometimes the translators themselves didn't know for sure what it was. So with the knowledge that we have, the many good men over the last, not recently many of them, but this one is recent, but they have done a great work in writing on some of these subjects and given us a better insight into some of the scriptures concerning this. But the only way that I know to approach this particular part of the book of Daniel, verses 5 through 35, is to read either here from the King James and then read his historical comments, because he has it all laid out as to who this person was and that person and this war and that war and this wife, who she was, and we even get into Cleopatra today and so forth. And the whole purpose is not that you will retain. I'm not trying to teach this so that you will retain these names and remember them. You might remember one or two of them. They might stick in your mind. You've heard Antiochus Epiphanes. You'll hear that enough till it'll probably stick in your mind. But the point, the blessing of this is this, that God gave Daniel this book, and he wrote this down hundreds of years before the events took place. And yet he tells precisely, doesn't give the names of the characters who fulfill those things, but history, just from the standpoint, I think that the Bible it's a spiritual book. Where it touches on history, it's accurate. Where it touches on science, it's accurate. And where it touches on any other area, it's accurate. But the Bible wasn't written to teach science. It wasn't written to teach history. It wasn't written to teach those things. It's written to be a spiritual book for us to get spiritual lessons and for us to learn about God and about His ways and about His Word. And that's what this passage does more than anything else. It says to us, God is so accurate. He understood, he pre-wrote history. He gave us all the events here that took place for approximately 150 years is involved in this period of time. And he gave us these events just so we would know that he knew. Because you're not going to remember, and I had a course, as I said last week, in this, took a course. Of course, it's been a long time ago. Most of the things that I knew that far back is gone, long since passed. But I remember the names, and some of the events are familiar, and some of the accounts, as I read them over, they refresh, and I remember some of those things. But that's not really important, to know all the historical facts of that period of time, unless you want to be a teacher of history, ancient history, and unless you want to, and that'd be a great thing to do, to teach that in a Bible college or a Christian school or that sort of thing. And it certainly is interesting to teach, but the main point is to understand when you get through that God wrote all of this in advance. He knew everything that was going to take place, and it took place precisely the way He said it would. In other words, that reinforces our faith in the Word of God. It reinforces us in understanding and knowing that what we believe is right. And if He's right about this, then He's right about all the rest of it, see? If He can tell this accurately, then we can trust it all. You see, that's the important part, to build our faith, to increase our faith, to make us trust the Lord better and to depend upon Him more. I think that's the most important aspect of this. Now, last time we read verses 5 through 20 from his translation, and I was reading, referred to the fact that it sounded almost like a soap opera, some of the characters of history. There's nothing new under the sun. The folks today and the ideas and the crookedness and the deceitfulness and all of the different things that people do today, they haven't done it the first time. It's been done before. And crooked politicians, egotistical politicians, people who thought they were more than they were, vain, full of pride, and all those things, people trying to use other people to get their ends, that's just as old as sin itself. And so we see all of that in this. I'm reading now, I'm going to pick up something we read last time, where Ptolemy, when you hear the word Ptolemy, that's P-T-O-L-E-M-Y, that's Egypt. Anytime you hear Ptolemy, he's from Egypt, say. If you learn the names and tie them to the land they come from, then you can understand a little bit better the wars. And if you hear Antiochus, which we're going to hear a lot of tonight, he is from Syria. Now, all of this period is written basically between two countries, Syria, north of Israel, and Egypt, south of Israel. And the reason God includes it in the book is because Israel is right in the middle of it. And that's all God's concerned about, is His people and those events that concern His people. And they were caught between these wars. Every time Syria would go south, they'd go through Israel to fight against Egypt. And every time Egypt would come back to fight it, they'd come north, they'd come through the Holy Land to fight. And so they were caught in a crossfire. And it was when they started taking sides, and usually the wrong side, that they began to get in trouble. And God began to work in them the things that He wanted to do to purify them and to teach them the things He wanted to teach them. So that's the tie with this. Now, Ptolemy got angry with the advances toward Egypt by Antiochus, and so he assembled an army consisting of 70,000 infantry, 5,000 cavalry, and 73 elephants. Now, those are tanks of those days, you understand. They didn't have 50 millimeters, but they had snouts that could spray water on you and sound worse than some of the tanks sound whenever they trumpet. And he marched against Antiochus. Now, we're moving north this time. This battle's going north. See, the king is moving against Antiochus. Now, Antiochus had 72,000 infantry, that's 2,000 more, 6,000 cavalry, that's 1,000 more, and 102 elephants. That's, 29 more elephants he's got. In 217 B.C., the two armies clashed at Raphia. Now, that was a great battle of history, too, by the way. Egypt won a great victory, as Antiochus lost 10,000 infantry, 300 cavalry, and 5 elephants through death, and 4,000 prisoners through capture. Ptolemy, king of Egypt, became very proud over his victory, but he did not press his advantage. Instead of retaking all lost territory from Syria, he returned home to his life of ease. If you remember last time, he'd rather carouse around than fight. He wasn't much of a fighter, but when he had to, he could. But soon as he whipped him, then he, instead of taking the land that they had taken from him, he just went back home. He figured that he'd learned his lesson, and he went back home to his life of ease. Then in 203, which would be, you see, some 14 years later, Ptolemy Philopater and his wife died. That's the king of Egypt, and his wife died. Their son, Ptolemy the Fifth, Epiphanes, became king of Egypt. And by the way, we're going to see a marriage later on that gets that name Epiphanes into the Antioch tribe. And that's how Antioch Epiphanes came to be later on, all right? So Ptolemy the Fifth became the king of Egypt when only 4 years old. Antiochus the Great saw this as the opportune time to retaliate against Egypt. He marched south with a larger, well-equipped army, which he had developed through some successful eastern campaigns during the 14 years since Raphia, since that last great battle. Now we're going south, see. The king of the north coming south. Antiochus did not fight Egypt alone. He made a league with Philip V of Macedonia, Egyptian rebels who opposed their child king, and Jewish men of violence who resented Egypt's influence in Israel. Now, that's the first time some of the Jewish men are getting involved. And we're going to see that more and more as time goes on. Egypt controlled Israel again after the Battle of Raphia in 217. See, Egypt had taken Israel because they had whipped him there at Raphia 14 years earlier, and so they had controlled Israel. So Israel doesn't like Egypt controlling them, so some of them side up with Antiochus. The Jewish rebels decided to help Antiochus the Great take Israel away from Egypt. They thought that their alliance with Syria would aid Israel, but instead it brought their nation into Syria's grasp and made it subject to the horrors that Antiochus Epiphanes would bring upon it in later years. Thus, their action helped to bring about the fulfillment of the vision in Daniel 8. Now, that if you look in at verse 14 in chapter 11, it says, "And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south." That's the alliance here that he's spoken of. "Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision." In other words, the robbers here are he calls them the rebels, Egyptian rebels. And before that, they're called men of violence, and that's the reference here. "Shall exalt themselves to establish vision, but they shall fall." In other words, they shall not exceed. So that's the area that we're in right now. All right, in 198 B.C., Antiochus the Great conquered a leading Egyptian general, Scopas, by besieging and conquering Sidon, the fortress city in which Scopas was located. Three attempts to rescue the besieged Scopas by three chosen Egyptian generals, Aripas, Menacles, and Demanes, failed. The victory for Syria ended Egypt's rule in Israel. Antiochus now had no opposition for some time. He had a free hand to do what he wanted in the Middle East. He came to Israel and took complete control of that land. Now, Antiochus treated the Jews well. He released Jerusalem from taxes for 3 years and sent money to the temple. And so, boy, the Jews thought they really had come out well in this deal by helping the king of the north. Whipped the king of the south and got rid of the Egyptian control. By this time, the rising power of Rome, now this is the first time Rome is mentioned, but historically, you see, you remember now that the Medo-Persian Empire had been destroyed by the he-goat, which represented the king of Greece, Alexander the Great, and then he died and the kingdom was split into four kingdoms. Two of those kingdoms were Syria and Egypt. See? And that's what we're talking about now. They were the outstanding, Alexander's conquered, area that he'd conquered was divided under his four generals. None of his children had any of it, but four generals divided up. And the two outstanding areas were the north and the south, Egypt and Syria. And that's what this is about. But now Rome is rising to power. And they're coming into the picture. And this will be the fourth of the kingdoms, remember, of the kingdom of iron legs and feet, and feet of and toes of iron and clay. Now, so Rome was beginning to threaten Syria's expansionist program. In light of this, Antiochus decided that he dare not risk the costly military invasion against the land of Egypt itself. Instead, he determined to bring Egypt under the control through a treaty. The threatening power of his enlarged kingdom gave him leverage to make Egypt agreeable to such a treaty. As part of the treaty, Antiochus married his daughter Cleopatra to the Egyptian king. Now remember that. He was a little older than four by this time, but he wasn't too old, too much older than that. He was about 10 years old at that time. Now, that doesn't sound like the Cleopatra that you read about in history, does it? But it's the same one. Of course, her father, Antiochus, intended to use her against the Egyptians. And she'd go down there, marry him, and then she'd corrupt the place from the inside and let him know what was going on. And it says here, Antiochus planned for his daughter to work for him against her husband. She was supposed to work from the inside to ruin Egypt as an opponent of Syria. The scheme didn't work. Cleopatra constantly sided with her husband against her father. So that didn't work for him. You wonder where these programs, General Hospital and Days of Your Life, get their themes. A lot of them probably read history. And maybe that's where they get some of it. Beginning in 197 B.C., Antiochus the Great conquered several Aegean islands and portions of Asia Minor and Thrace. He even invaded and conquered parts of Greece. Rome was seeking to control these areas, so Antiochus boasted concerning what he was doing to Roman interests. Rome sent the Roman general Lucius Cornelius Scipio to deal with him. In 191 B.C., Scipio forced him out of Greece. In 190 B.C., Scipio defeated Antiochus terribly in the Battle of Magnesia in Asia Minor. In 188 B.C., the Romans forced him to relinquish all of Asia Minor. Now the Romans boasted concerning what they were doing to Antiochus' interests. And, of course, this is when the shift is taking place to that fourth kingdom, the Roman kingdom. Antiochus the Great had been defeated so soundly that he had to withdraw to the protection of his own land, Syria, never again to conquer the strongholds of other lands. In 187 B.C., he was killed while trying to rob a temple in Elam in order to replenish his exhausted treasury. Antiochus the Great was succeeded by his son, Seleucus the Fourth, Philopater. The Romans required him to pay 1,000 talent tribute each year. This forced him to levy heavy taxes on the people of his kingdom. Seleucus sent his prime minister, Heliodorus, to Jerusalem to take the wealth of the temple treasury. A short time after this, Seleucus suddenly and mysteriously died, probably of poisoning, in 176 B.C. Now, if you look at verse 20, which is the end of this portion that we've just read, it says, "Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle." See how precisely that was fulfilled? And he didn't live very long, Seleucus. Now, this period is approximately 147 years, from verse 5 to verse 20. Now, I'm at verse 21. You read, unless you have your book along, you can read with me in his translation, but you read the translation in King James here. Now we're fixing to get to the little horn, Antiochus Epiphanes, who is a type of the Antichrist. When we get to verse 36, then we're going to shift from Antioch Epiphanes to the Antichrist. Through verse 35 is past. Verse 36 starts future, which will take place at the end of time in the tribulation period. Now, I'm reading verse 21. "And in his place, a despicable person will arise on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred. But he will come in a time of tranquility and seized the kingdom by intrigue. And the overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. Now, I want you to notice as we read about this little horn that, as referred to back in chapter 8, I guess it was, that we read about, that he is very much a type of the Antichrist. He takes the kingdom by intrigue. He rises to such great power. He's a flatterer. He's a smooth worker. You, as we read through this, you get a picture of what some of the things that Antichrist. So he seizes the kingdom by intrigue. Now, and after an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception, and he will go up and gain power with a small force of people. He starts out very small, and that's what Antichrist. In a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm. Remember that it will be in the time of peace, in the first 3.5 years of tribulation, that he does all of his, he sets himself up in that fashion. And he will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He will distribute plunder, booty, and possessions among them, and he will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time. Now you see, he is not greedy in the sense that he wants it all and gets everything for himself. He understands that if he's going to have alliances with people, he's got to give them lands and give them money. And that's the way he buys people. That's the way he gets them on his side. So he distributes his plunder. It wasn't his. He stole it, took it from other places, but he distributes it, so that keeps him off his back. And he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army. This battle's still going on between Egypt and Syria. So the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war, but he will not stand. For schemes will be devised against him, and those who eat his choice food will destroy him. In other words, his high-up leaders sell the king of Egypt out. And his army will overflow, but many will fall down slain. As for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil. Get that, they will be intent on evil, and they will speak lies to each other at the same table. You ever hear? Does that sound familiar? What? Nothing new under the sun. That sound like North and South Korea? It sound like Vietnam? It sound like most of the other truces and things that have been made, doesn't it? Speak lies to each other at the same table. And you remember, you know, of course, they had such a hard time deciding what shape the table was going to be in. You know, that table is very important. But it will not succeed, for the end is still to come at the appointed time. Now get that phrase, because what that says is God is not ready for it to end yet. He's still got to punish his people. He's still got to put them through the trials to purify them and so forth. And so it says to us also that God's in charge of time. He sets the time. Then he will return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the holy covenant, and he will take action and then return to his own land. At the appointed time, he will return and come into the south, but this last time it will not turn out the way it did before, for ships of Kittim will come against him. Therefore, he will be disheartened, and by the way, those are from Rome, and will return and become enraged at the holy covenant and take action. See, he's always running back and forth through the Holy Land, down to the south and back up. Well, whenever he gets cut off down there and the ships come against him of Rome and he has to head back up, then he takes it out against the Jews. And that's when we come to this awful time that we have concerning him. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. In other words, he lines up with the Jews who have already forsaken the holy covenant. They are not worshiping the true God. And he lines up with them. This is, of course, history. We're not talking about future now. We're talking about past. And this happened just that way. What they were trying to do were they were trying to get rid of the whole Jewish system and Hellenize, or in other words, put the Greek culture in to Palestine and get rid of the covenant, the holy people, make them forget their God, forget their laws, forget their worship, and be westernized, we would say today, Hellenized it would be, that speaks of the Greek culture, all right? Now, and forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice. And they will set up the abomination of desolation, and by smooth words, now he's the Antichrist again, he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant. But the people who know their God will display strength and take action. And those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many. Yet they will fall by sword and by flame, by captivity and by plunder for many days. Now when they fall, they will be granted a little help, and many will join with them in hypocrisy. And some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end time. See, that's the purpose of it. Because it is still to come at the appointed time. God's going to let it go until the appointed time. Now, I hope I can get some of this history in here at this time, because I'd like to wrap up through verse 35. So next time we can take up the future Antichrist. Seleucus IV, who died mysteriously, was succeeded by Antiochus IV Epiphanes. Now we come to this king. That was 175 to 164 as king of Syria. Antiochus was so contemptible that his contemporaries nicknamed him Madman. Instead of the title that he gave himself, the God made manifest. That's what he called himself. Theos Epiphanes, the God made manifest. Antiochus was not the rightful heir to the throne. One of Seleucus' two sons was the rightful heir. However, when Antiochus heard about Seleucus' death, he came to Syria and took the throne, not by waging war, but by the use of flattery and intrigue. Early in Antiochus' rule, Egypt prepared an army to march against him. When Antiochus learned about this, he marched his Syrian army south to attack the Egyptian army. Antiochus completely routed this opponent in 170 B.C. at a battle which took place on the Mediterranean seacoast, halfway between Gaza and the Nile Delta. Antiochus allowed Onias III, the high priest of Israel, to be deposed and replaced by his brother Jason. Jason had wanted Greek culture established in Israel, but Onias was opposed to this. Onias was called the Prince of the Covenant because it was the high priest's responsibility to see that Israel kept its covenant with God. Antiochus offered friendship to Egypt in order to get it to let down its guard against him. Having accomplished this, he then proceeded to try to gain control of Egypt through deceitful means. In spite of the small size to which Rome had reduced his Syrian kingdom, Antiochus began to rise in power. Antiochus robbed the richest parts of his own kingdom when they did not expect to be plundered. He did not squander his wealth upon himself as his ancestors had done. Instead, he very generously distributed it among his poor subjects in order to gain their support. He's a good Democrat. He planned to take Egypt's fortresses to serve his ends, but God had decreed only so much time for him. Antiochus and Ptolemy battled each other with huge armies when Antiochus invaded Egyptian territory. Ptolemy was soundly defeated because some of his own men and his royal court plotted against him and aided the Syrian enemy. Many Egyptian soldiers were killed. Ptolemy was overthrown as king of Egypt and taken captive by Antiochus. Some Egyptians crowned Ptolemy his brother, Ptolemy the VII, as king of Egypt in Alexandria. In light of this new development, Antiochus pretended to befriend captured Philometor in order to obtain his help against his brother. Antiochus promised to reconquer Egypt for him to restore him as king. He pretended to believe Antiochus, but both intended to use the other to gain control of all Egypt. Of course, Egypt always been prized down there, the Nile, and that delta land, things down there. The intentions of both failed. Antiochus did conquer the city of Memphis, but failed to take Alexandria. Then he returned home without taking all of Egypt. Now, I'm going to skip some here. Although he had not conquered all Egypt, he did take much wealth from it to carry home to Syria. Before this Egyptian campaign, Antiochus had removed Jason as high priest of Israel and replaced him with Menelaus. Menelaus had sought this position by offering Antiochus higher tribute money, pay him more, a higher percentage to have the job. While Antiochus was fighting in Egypt, Jason heard a false rumor to the effect that Antiochus was dead. Jason raised a Jewish force and attacked Jerusalem to overthrow Menelaus. Menelaus beat off the attack, but as Antiochus returned home through Israel, he determined to teach the Jews, the rebel Jews, a lesson. He slaughtered many Jews, sold many into slavery, plundered the temple of its valuable contents, and carried these sacred things of God to Syria. This showed his personal contempt for Israel's covenant relationship with God. When Antiochus learned that Ptolemy had formed a coalition with Euergetes to rule Egypt jointly, he felt betrayed. As a result, he invaded Egypt a third time in 168 B.C., Christ told Daniel that the time of this invasion had been appointed sovereignly by God. This third invasion did not have the successful outcome for Antiochus that the first invasion of 170 had had. While Antiochus was besieging Alexandria, the Romans sent Linnaeus with many soldiers in the ships to prevent Antiochus from taking Egypt. When Linnaeus told Antiochus that the Roman Senate wanted him to leave Egypt, Antiochus stalled for time. Linnaeus drew a circle around Antiochus and told him to decide either to leave Egypt or to fight Rome before leaving the circle. Antiochus was so fearful of Rome's power that he left Egypt, but very reluctantly and dejected. With great bitterness of heart, he decided to vent his wrath upon the people of Israel, who were opposing his efforts to enforce Greek culture upon the nation. He gave special favors to Menelaus and his apostate Jewish followers who were rejecting the true worship of God in favor of the Hellenization process. Antiochus ordered his general to occupy Jerusalem with Syrian troops for the purpose of stamping out every trace of Judaism and replacing it with Hellenism. The Syrian soldiers stationed themselves in the temple, the fortress which guarded the temple. An edict was made that all nationalities in Antiochus' kingdom were to be fused into one people. There we go, eliminate you races. Get rid of the Jews by intermarrying, see, with the rest of them. Never have been able to do it. All were to worship Greek deities. An Athenian philosopher was sent to Jerusalem. They sent him a psychologist to supervise the enrollment of the edict. Philosopher. The regular temple sacrifices to God were stopped. Syrian soldiers and harlots performed licentious heathen rites in the temple courts. Pigs were sacrificed to Greek gods in the temple. Jews were required to take part in a drunken orgy in honor of Bacchus, the god of wine. Jews who tried to offer sacrifice to God, practice circumcision, or observe the Sabbath or feast days were put to death. The Old Testament was ordered destroyed. A pagan altar was erected over the altar of God, and the temple was rededicated to Zeus. This was the abomination of desolation that was caused by Antiochus. So that this is just the type of what Antichrist is going to do. This fellow was he was the instrument, of course, of Satan himself. Those apostate Jews who already had deserted the worship of God were flattered by Antiochus into completely perverting the faith of Israel. In order to remain high priest, Menelaus turned to the service of Zeus. But those Jews who knew God personally through faith took a strong stand for him and acted in obedience to God's covenant with Israel. Now here's where the Maccabees come in. I imagine some of you have read the Maccabees, and in the Apocrypha, those books that are in some Bibles, between the Old and New Testament, Catholic Bible among others, there's a lot of two or three books of by the Maccabees, and they were some people who came to be at that time. Mattathias Maccabeus, a priest of God, and his five sons refused to forsake the covenant of God. They understood the issues of the day and could distinguish clearly between the truth of God and the errors of Hellenism. See, they're going to be represented, they're representatives of what will be the 144,000 in the tribulation period. Now, Mattathias refused to offer the pagan sacrifice and killed Antiochus' representative who ordered him to offer it. He and his sons forsook their personal possessions and fled the mountains. Through this example, they gave many others understanding of the issues of the day. Others joined them in their revolt against Antiochus' repressive measures. This was the beginning of the Maccabean revolt. These people paid a high price. Many of them were killed and abused by Syrian forces. From time to time, small groups of men joined the Maccabees to help them in their revolt against the Syrian oppression. Many uncommitted Jews sided with the Maccabees hypocritically for expediency's sake. They did this when they saw the Maccabees winning, and in order to escape the fierce punishment that the Maccabees brought upon the apostate Jews. Several of Mattathias Maccabeus' sons were killed while leading the people of Israel, who remained faithful to God's covenant. One other faithful Jew suffered similar fates. God permitted these things to happen to his people so that they might be purified in order to serve him more effectively. Christ indicated that such a refining process of God's people would go on, not only during the persecution of Antiochus Epiphanes, but also throughout the entire end time. The word translated until also means during. This refining process would continue until the time that God has appointed for it to end, the end of the end time at the second coming of Christ. Once again, Daniel was reminded of two things. First, God is sovereign. He has determined the significant times of history. Second, Israel would continue to be persecuted until Christ's second coming. Now with that ends the historical part there. And with the next verse, 36, we pick up with what will take place at the end. Prophecy moves forward to the end time. I know we went rather hastily through that, and if you have the copy of the book, you can go back and maybe spend a little more time at it if you'd like, and maybe digest a little more of that particular point. But the beautiful thing is, God gave it to Daniel, and then it was acted out over that particular part over some 200 years.